I'm Freddie, host of Unforgotten, a podcast series which dives into the 2009 unsolved murder of Matt Stewart. The following is a special question and answer episode, featuring a conversation recorded earlier this week between myself and Steve, moderator of the Unforgotten Forum. If you have any suggestions about topics or questions to be included in future special episodes, you can submit them on the forum, located at unforgotten.freeforums.net.
Well, we're back again. Q&A number two for season two. Ready to answer some questions. Got some feedback on my Apple Podcast reviews that the question and answer episodes are too repetitive and not as much new information. So I'm just going to make this the most exciting. I'm going to break out so much new stuff that people don't know. It's going to blow your mind. People are going to start complaining that it's not repetitive enough.
Okay, I guess you have been getting these comments, huh? And I agree some of the Q&A stuff has been repetitive, but it's because people keep asking similar questions.
It's true. That's true. And a lot of times questions we don't know the answers to. So,
and the whole point of the Q&A is just to try to hit on the things that people are having difficulty understanding or that we've presented badly. So it's not going to be new information typically, right? That's not our goal here.
Right. Yeah. I mean, if there's like a new thing, it's going to be in the episodes.
All right. Well, let's jump right in and start with a question about the store that we visited. Curious asked on the forum what we learned about the possible existence of evidence on the tapes that the police would have had access to. What more do you know about what might have been on them?
In terms of the tapes, the only things that I've heard were from Toylene Franco, who has since passed away, had told me that there had been security cameras pointed, I guess, vaguely in that direction, and that she had been told by the police that they apprehended those tapes and that there was nothing on them to help with the investigation, which I took it as that they had not gotten at least a clear image of the suspect, or maybe they didn't get the suspect at all because maybe he didn't come from that way. I don't know if you picked up anything else from that experience going to the Shell station.
No, I don't feel that particular owner, I guess we decided there were at least two owners, maybe there were brothers.
Yep.
And it was probably the other brother that the police would have talked to. So this guy didn't have any firsthand recollection of anything going on at that time. But my general feeling was that even if the police had seen something, they weren't going to relay that back to the shop owners.
I guess that makes sense. Part of the reason that we went in there was because if there had been tapes and there had been, you know, the suspect had gone by there or maybe even had gone in to the store, I would imagine that he as the owner may have been questioned, especially if he was there at that time. He may have been questioned about what he saw and that may have been memorable and that he could relay what kind of questions he was asked. But that wasn't the case, at least with the owner that we spoke to. He had no recollection.
Okay. Also, my question about the milk seemed to confuse a couple people. I sometimes get confused as to what we've discussed between us and what was public knowledge. Has the milk story been mentioned before?
Not on the podcast. For those that have done a fair amount of Googling, it's probably no secret that there's a post on another forum that was posted years ago that talked about somebody buying milk at a convenience store the night of the murder.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, that brings me to something else Curious mentioned in one of her posts, that she had heard two distinctly different accounts from that night from Brenda, one about a premonition and another about bringing milk and checking in. Have these two stories ever been reconciled from what you've heard?
Reconciled in that they can coexist?
Well, they seem to be almost two different stories. And most of the people who have provided the information seem to have heard one or the other. I personally, in talking with you and seeing posts on the forum, haven't seen anything that combined the two in any kind of logical way to encompass both possibilities.
There's an individual that I've spoken with who claims to have had a conversation or conversations with officers that were at the scene of the crime, and what he has conveyed to me would create some kind of coherence between those two accounts. coherence maybe is not the right word because it still doesn't make any logical sense. But he and multiple other individuals have expressed to me that they heard recounts of Brenda's experience or what she did that night that encompass those two accounts of her being there earlier at the house and bringing milk, and also the premonition, the bad dream, and her driving to the house.
All right. Another question was about the time of death. Have we ever heard anything official about it? Did any of the many experts you've talked to have any opinion on it?
The one piece of information that, to me, creates the most legitimate doubt or curiosity would be the autopsy, that basically the only part of the report that is not filled out is the time of death. But from talking to Dr. Judy Melnick last year, she had mentioned that that is not particularly out of the ordinary to have the time of death missing. But, you know, to me, it's definitely noteworthy that there's not a listed time of death when there is a listed time of attack and a time of entry into the house.
Some of the listeners who are of a more skeptical type have wondered if the murder could have happened earlier than originally thought. And BLJ asks, you seem to doubt the timeline Angel gives for the events. What has led you to doubt her version of the time?
A couple different things. For one, the police call log, it shows basically that the response time of the two squad cars was under 4 minutes, which is a pretty fast response time. If all of this was happening in the way that she said, and she ran from the house immediately once the attack began. So judging from that, you've got about 4 or 5 minutes. And then judging from the autopsy, looking at the multitude of wounds and what we know about the scene from witness testimony, I have a hard time reconciling that shots wouldn't have been going off or stabbing wouldn't have been occurring when the squad cars got there.
Okay. Forum member Batman has a few questions as well, the first of which is about the berm in the back of the house and what our current opinions happen to be about the likelihood of that being the escape route. We've said a lot of things about it and heard from people with opinions in both directions, so I suppose it's appropriate that we each give our personal opinion on it. For me, I see the berm in the condition that it was at the time of the murder through old satellite photos, and it looks to me like it would have been as easily passable as it has ever been, that it wasn't overgrown at that time. Just walking the neighborhood, it doesn't feel like any other escape route would make sense, especially given that 4 minute response time of the officers coming into the neighborhood. So my personal opinion is that I think they came over the berm in the first place, went back that way, and either had a accomplice waiting to take them away from the scene, or had parked a vehicle of some sort there to get away quickly. What are your thoughts?
I would say that that's entirely possible. One anecdote that I haven't shared yet comes from two neighbors who lived on that street at the time of the murder, who both remember a path existing through the brush of the berm in or around the Stewart's backyard that one of the individuals remembers going through on multiple occasions as a shortcut to get to the Shell station to buy cigarettes.
Well, that certainly means it's possible.
So that means that it's passable. If they went through the berm, I think investigators left the crime scene knowing that that's where they went.
And Batman's second question was this. Does Freddie believe law enforcement knows all these bizarre facts that Freddie is uncovering, like the mom offering money to use a neighbor's phone, and they just can't talk about it? Or would this be a totally new revelation to them? And his own opinion was, if so, they suck at investigating.
I don't know what they know or don't know. I can tell you, and I can tell you that before I confirmed Danielle's story, when I had just heard it as a rumor, when I was unable to reach her in a period of a few weeks or a month, I did call the Mooresville Police Department and relayed to them that rumor that I had heard about the neighbor named Danielle. And I gave them her full name and her address at the time. And I expressed what people had told me just in case they did not know. So, you know, I want to be sure that if I get any kind of solid tips that seem like they could be important, I'm going to always pass those on to investigators.
Okay, let's talk about the two cliffhangers in the episode, which generated a lot of buzz. First, in the intro, there was a description about the special response team entering a house, but that house wasn't the Stewart's home. What was going on there, and what was the purpose of this other raid?
Well, before searching the Stewart's house on the morning of the murder, the special response team had searched Danielle's house, and Danielle had lived a few houses down from the Stewart's. So that's the house I was referring to was Danielle's house.
And I guess we'll learn more about the details of that in the coming episode?
Yes.
Okay, then we have the cliffhanger at the end of the episode, an unusual offer to pay hundreds of dollars to use someone's cell phone. This certainly sounds very unusual, and will we be hearing more about this in the coming episode? And more importantly, what can you tell us now?
Yeah, it's definitely unusual. It will be the focus of the coming episode, will be the interview that I've done with Danielle and other people close to her and other neighbors in that vicinity that remember this experience taking place. It's really weird. I can only relay what I've been told. I'm not going to broadcast every rumor that I hear. Any kind of weird thing that somebody relays to me, I'm not just going to go ahead and put it on the podcast. But at the same time, I'm also not going to not allow people to tell their stories, especially if there's at least some corroborating what they've said. And I had heard from multiple neighbors, as well as actually, unbeknownst to them, family members of Matt, whose stories mesh together with the narrative that is kind of unfolding now of this SRT going to a house up the street and of there being an individual there that interacted with the family and was there in the aftermath of all of this for hours. Danielle's story is something that I've been chasing for a really long time. I'm not going to stand behind everything that she says and say it's accurate, but I think that it's important that people know, and I'll be trying to articulate this or show this in the best way possible, is that she didn't listen to my podcast and make this up. There are people that have heard her story for years. There are people that were there that saw it. There are people that heard her recount this the day after the murder. You know, there's pieces that kind of fit together loosely. And I'm going to also be bringing up some old interviews, parts of old interviews that never were on the podcast, that will kind of explain this more, that kind of gave me clues to that this was something that happened before I actually realized the significance. All of that sounds very confusing right now, but it will make sense in the coming episode.
I know from my conversations with you that there are definitely things going on behind the scenes that you're not at liberty to talk about. Do you feel like the case might be moving forward again finally?
It certainly feels like it. I think that my goal that the podcast would spur people to come forward with information, whether that be relevant or irrelevant, is definitely coming to fruition. Whether or not it's going to yield any kind of definitive results, people in the community are coming forward with things, and I'm passing that information on through the proper channels. And I think that's a really good thing. I would encourage anyone out there that knows anything that hasn't come forward, reach out to law enforcement. If you don't feel comfortable doing that, reach out to me. Let's get all the information out. It's been 10 years. We got to move it forward.
I agree. All right. Well, I'm sure we're all looking forward to the next episode. When can we expect it?
In a week or so, at the end of April. Still sticking to the one episode a month time frame.
All right. That's it. That's it for me.
All right.
Unforgotten is a Bold Era production, written and recorded by myself, Freddie Wilson, in the always sunny Daytona Beach, Florida. As always, this series is dedicated to the life of Matt Stewart. May his memory remain unforgotten.